Exodus chapter 18, verses 1 through 27. As I have been doing in recent weeks, we will cover this chapter and these verses. I'll be embedding the text, so to speak, in the message, but we will cover the entire chapter today. But the point of emphasis that I want to make to you is all of these priorities. You know, in recent weeks, we've been tracking as the Israelites have made their way across the wilderness toward the promised land, and we've talked about none of these diseases, none of these complaints. Today, it's all of these priorities. Let me begin by saying that it happens on occasion. A problem will arise in your life that becomes so complicated that we cannot seem to find a way out of it. As we see what Moses has been dealing with and what he's dealing with here in these verses, he may well have felt that way as he leads these Hebrew people across the wilderness. In the Lord's plan, however, in spite of his feeling overwhelmed and set upon, someone's going to show up in his life, someone he'd never dreamed would be used of God to provide him a way out, a solution to the problems. Now, you know, in the culture in which we live, some people have experienced what have been called burnout or exhaustion. Somebody once described it this way: being burned out occurs when, in sheer exhaustion and frustration, one loses all hope of meeting the standards imposed on them, either by themselves or by others or both, and simply gives up. Some of you may be surprised to learn that one profession where, according to people who know about such things, where burnout has become common is in that of Christian ministry. You know, this is another of the, what I'll call the dirty little secrets of the church growth movement. Let me explain what I mean. You have these church leaders whose personal and family lives go into meltdown as they try to meet the unrealistic goals of achieving the successful mega church. You know, they want to be just like Rick Warren and Saddleback Church. They want to be just like the late Robert Schuller in his heyday with the Crystal Cathedral, or Bill Hybels before he fed on hard times in the Willow Creek Church. And all the rest of them. You know, people don't realize that the communities around this country are dotted with these little fiefdoms, these little mega churches, each with their own version of a Rick Warren, you know, or whoever the latest mega church pastor is. I'm not going to call the name, but there was a name mentioned to me several times, and occasionally he's still in the news. He was pastor of a big, big church here. I never heard of the guy. So, I mean, I had been in New York for 18 years, in Arizona for 1 year. I never heard of this guy, but he was big news here in this area. But you see, in the end, many church leaders with those kinds of aspirations, they end up crashing and burning. And very often, those closest to them don't survive the crash. Now, as we look here into chapter 18 of Exodus, we find that Moses has come very close to exhaustion. But then his father-in-law shows up. And what at first appears to be sort of a random casual visit from a relative, well, it becomes a point of divine provision and intervention. So let's look at verses 1 through 5. Unless otherwise noted, these readings are all from the English Standard Version. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and how Yahweh, the Lord, brought Israel out of Egypt. Now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home, along with her two sons. The name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. I keep thinking when I see that name of the great Robert A. Heinlein science fiction novel, Stranger in a Strange Land. That's just where he got the title from. And verse 4, and the name of the other is Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father, that's the El, E-L part of the name, it's pronounced O or El in Hebrew and Aramaic, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the hand or the sword of Pharaoh. Verse 5, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now, I am using these verses to address an issue that may be a problem for some folks. It's definitely been an issue for many, many people. Maybe not so much in this pandemic age where most people aren't doing much work anymore. But one way of describing the problem for those who do get burned out is burning the candle at both ends. You know what happens if you cut away the wax end of each end of a candle and you light both ends? Well, within a short time, the candle burns itself down to nothing. That is one problem. It should be added, too, that at the other end of the spectrum are some folks who have just the opposite problem. The problem isn't that the candle is lit at either end for them. They're not burning the candle at both ends. They're not burning it at either end. So, now, those are two common problems in life generally. But I think our text shows us that those are problems particularly common in the life of the church. You say, well, where does it show us that? Because this is what we're dealing with in this text. This is the old covenant church, the nascent old covenant church of the Lord. And therefore, it's applicable to us today. You know, it's been my experience as a pastor for almost 30 years, and it's been the experience of many other pastors, elders, deacons, Sunday school teachers, and other church workers, that one reason some people get burned out and exhausted from doing the work of the church is because so many other people are not doing anything at all for the work of the church. I've been a pastor of some churches where you could count on one hand the number of people in a church of 150 that you had five or six people who were doing 80%, 90% of the work. And people like that get burned out after a while. They just get fed up. So friends, here's a point for all of us to remember. If we are not doing our share of the church's work and labor, then either someone else is doing it or it's not getting done. Now, we see here that Moses' father-in-law was delighted to hear what the Lord had done for Israel. And in verses 10 to 12, we're not going to read them, but let me just tell you, he considers this great news of the deliverance, and he offers praises to the Lord in verse 10, and then he actually offers a sacrifice to Yahweh in verse 12. Now, it happens that the day following Jethro's arrival, he has an opportunity to observe firsthand what Moses, as the leader of Israel, was doing. And we will read these verses 13 to 16. The next day, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. Notice that. When Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, and all the people stand around you from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me, and I decide between one person and another, and I make them know the statutes of God and his laws." So Moses is taking pretty much all day to adjudicate cases brought to him by the people. And Jethro says to him in verse 15, or he tells Jethro, excuse me, in verse 15, they're coming to me to find out God's will. The people want justice. I mean, isn't that true of everybody? Those people recognize that justice is a religious fact. And so they come to Moses. They come to him because God had already greatly used Moses and was, in a sense, close to Moses. But now Jethro has a solution to the oppressive burden that Moses is facing here. Both those men would later confess that this solution from Jethro was of divine origin. It's divine guidance. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, Moses declares that, we're not going to look at it right now, but you can look at it later, Deuteronomy 1, 9 to 18. Moses declares that this is God's decision being given to him here. What Jethro proposes and Moses confirmed was a system of what we might call ranked, R-A-N-K-E-D, ranked courts, or a system of ascending courts of justice or consideration. Elders of the tribes would be chosen over 10 families, over 50 families, over hundreds, over thousands, and on up to what would eventually be called the highest court, the Sanhedrin. That is 70 elders plus the high priest. Jethro observes that one of the main problems was the making of every decision at this point was on the shoulders of one man, Moses. So it falls to Moses to act as the negotiator for every kind of dispute and issue in among these people. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. Well, not surprisingly, given the numbers of the people in the community of Israel, that's almost a round-the-clock job. Now, verse 14 says it went on from morning till evening. And needless to say, That's an enormous undertaking. And many of these Israelites had to stand around all day, and many would still not have had the opportunity to present their problems to Moses, and so they're frustrated. Strangely, it must have never occurred to Moses to ask for some help to deal with this overwhelming task, and even equally bizarre, it must have never occurred to the Israelites to suggest someone help Moses. You know, it raises this question in my mind, at least. Have you ever stopped to consider that there are things that you do, that we do a particular way, for no other reason than that we've always done it that way before? Maybe as you consider this story, you don't identify with Moses here. Perhaps you can therefore play the role of Jethro to somebody. Perhaps the Lord has an opportunity for you to show concern for someone else's welfare. Look at verses 17 to 18. Moses' father-in-law said to him, "What you are doing is not good. You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to do it alone." So Jethro's point was that Moses was going to do damage to himself and to the people. In more modern terms, we might have told Moses, look, getting an ulcer and losing your family and going to an early grave is not going to bring honor to God. So what should Moses do? Indeed, what should we do as we face similar kinds of issues? Well, let me suggest the following things. As the title of the sermon indicates, one of these is to establish proper priorities. Look with me at verses 19 to 20. "Now obey my voice, I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and you shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do." So I think it's worth noting that Jethro not only names the problem, he also offers a solution. And again, using more modern ways of describing it, what he does is to help Moses define priorities. People have sometimes very poorly defined priorities, or priorities that are just completely mixed up. I remember reading a story many years ago from the early 1990s, I think. So I'm not talking about New York City today. This is New York City back in the early 90s. It was a report that in a two-day period in New York City, a homeless man, a train maintenance worker, and a dog were all killed on the subway tracks of New York City. Say, what's that got to do with priorities? I'm going to tell you. 90 people telephoned the transit authority to express great concern about the death of that dog on the track. 3 people called about the death of the transit worker. Nobody called about the death of the homeless man. What a disturbing indicator of priorities. Jethro tells Moses what his first priority ought to be, and that is to act as an intercessor, a teacher of the people. Stand before God for the people that you may bring the difficulties to God, verse 19. Moses' task is to represent the people to God, to lay their cases before the Lord. His primary responsibility, his priority, is to spend time seeking God's will for the people. I think maybe another way of putting this would be that we all need to be able to distinguish between the crises that arise in our lives from time to time from the calling of our career or giftedness of our lives. What if somebody were to ask you, who is the minister of Reedy River Bible Presbyterian Church? Well, I suspect most of you would say, oh, well, that's Pastor Roberts. He's got the title, pastor. Or you might expand it a little bit and say, well, the minister is the pastor and the elders, the pastor and the session. But I think in either case, you would be incorrect. See, there's still this misconception in many places that the ministry of the church is something performed by the pastor and the staff. But the Bible teaches that the people of the church are the ministers. God's plan for the pastor and the session, according to Ephesians 4, that passage we heard a few moments ago, especially verse 12, is to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. If you've got I've been in churches, First Presbyterian Church down in Columbia. I was a member of that church for a while. They have over 2,000, at least at that time, they had over 2,000 members of that church. They had a session large enough to fill two churches. I mean, they had must have had 60 people on their session. That's a lot of people. But even with that number of people, you can't have 50 or 60 people doing all the work of the church, even with a pastoral staff, three or four pastors in a big session. If you've got 2 or 3,000 people or more, everybody has a part to play. I don't think it matters if you are a student in school, a mother or a father, an employee or an employer. Everyone should establish priorities. In our day and time, there's simply too many demands on our time to be able to do everything we need to do, and do them well, I should add. Here, let me suggest, based on the teachings of God's Word, something else about priorities. For example, the priority of not neglecting our relationship with God. That's a big priority. That obviously assumes, though, that we have a relationship with God, and if you don't, well, then you've got a much bigger and more pressing priority. Somebody said, you know, they knew about this old recipe for rabbit stew, and the first point of the recipe was, first, catch the rabbit. Somebody said the writer knew how to put first things first. That's what we do when we establish priorities. We put the things that should be first in first place, the proper order. And then there's the priority of not neglecting the family or the important relationships in life. No job, no career, no academic degree, no wild dream or fantasy is worth losing your family. After Moses had determined what God's will was, his second priority was to communicate it to the people. In verse 20, his father-in-law told him that he is to teach the people. He says, "You shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do." You know, according to people who study these kind of things, the work of being a pastor of a church is one of the most challenging and difficult in America today. Now, lest you think I'm just being self-serving here by quoting this, just hold on a minute. The pastoral ministry varies, in some cases, dramatically from one church to the next. But listen to me. The reason the people who study such things about job burnout and stress have said this, the explanation for that, in my opinion, is because of the way non-Christian and non-biblical ideas have influenced the way seminaries train pastors, and the way those same ideas have filtered into the churches and to the church members. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about because it may not be clear. I don't know, this goes back 30, 40, 50 years. You know, I mentioned these mega churches at the beginning, and this is the origin of a lot of this whole idea of the big, big mega church. Certain pastors who had grown tired of the biblical recipe and they really didn't want to follow the biblical pattern, they started looking for other avenues of growing the church. And they started looking at business models based on corporate growth. You know, you've got a company like, say, a Walmart. You know, it starts as this little tiny family-owned department store in Arkansas, and now look at it, it's a worldwide corporation. Like, how in the world did they do this great thing? And so they begin appropriating these non-biblical models for growing the church. And so the church becomes more like a business and a corporation. I'm not exaggerating, folks. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. There are churches where you can go to that church and they have a cafe that sells Starbucks coffee. I have the Starbucks logo out in front of the church. I've seen it. Now, this I've not seen, but I've heard on good authority it's the truth. There are churches that have where you can get your oil changed at the church. They have an oil change, 5-minute oil change thing at the church where you can get that done. Aerobics classes, all kinds of things. It's sort of like a mall where you can do all kinds of things, but it's all run by the church. And the pastor of these kind of churches, the pastor becomes more like the CEO of a corporation. I've had the opportunity to talk to one of these sorts of people. I'm not going to mention the name or the church or the location. But suffice to say that this man was pastor of a well-known big mega church in the area in which I used to live. And I had an opportunity to sit down with him one-on-one and ask a few questions that I've always wanted to ask somebody who's head of a church like that. And I said, well, what about people who have concerns, you know, they need pastoral guidance and counseling. You know, can they make an appointment with you and sit down? No, 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 he said, we got people to handle that. So, you know, if it's like if you want to go to the talk to the president of the bank, well, you don't get to the president of the bank. You got to talk to the second or third vice president, and you might not ever see the big shot, so to speak. That's how many of these churches are patterning things. See, biblically speaking, a man can pastor a church and have it grow to immense size and still not be doing the work a pastor is to be primarily about. According to the Bible, a pastor is first and foremost a teacher. He can oversee a beehive of programs and community outreach services. He can serve on boards and councils in the local community and the denomination. He can win awards for service and recognition from his peers. So he can do all of that and still not be doing the work of a pastor according to the Bible. His primary work, the first and foremost that he's called to do, is teach. Teach the people how they must walk in the Lord's ways and what God expects of them. And in doing that, he will also deal with the issues that Moses is dealing with here. People are not born knowing how to be leaders in the church of Jesus Christ. They have to be taught. Men who come to be officers in the church, either elders or deacons, they may bring skills and talents that they've learned from other places. And those things may be of use to some extent in the church. But being an officer in the church is not the same thing as being the supervisor on the job site or the boss at work. And that should be no surprise to us. I mean, if you served and serve well as an elder in the church, you would not for a moment, I don't think, assume that just because of that, you had the ability and the knowledge to assume some major leadership role in the corporate office of some business somewhere. You would, of course, understand that doing something like that requires training and talent and experience. The same is true in the work of the church. And teaching is a vital part of that training. To teach is to lay out the potential to increase the leadership of the church. And to increase the leadership is to multiply the opportunities to do the Lord's work better and more efficiently. So that leads then to another priority, and that is the training of qualified leaders. Look at verse 21. Moses is told to do is to delegate responsibility to qualified leaders. Moreover, look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. You notice the characteristics of the men who are to share this work with Moses in the administration of justice. They are to be able men. Now the word translated able in most Bibles, it comes from a Hebrew term that means strength, virtue, wealth, maybe like a force of an army. The judges or the elders are to be a moral force, an army of virtue, and hence a wealth, a source of riches to the people. Secondly, they are to be men who fear God. They must be men of religious dedication to justice, men who are strong in upholding God's law. And they must be trustworthy. That means they must be firm in their adherence to the truth. And the connotation is one of dependability, being strong support in the cause of God's justice, and then they must have a desire to be honest in their dealings monetarily. They must hate covetousness, despising bribery and payoffs. A godly character is mandatory for a godly office, and the administration of justice requires it. You note that Jethro does not suggest to Moses that he appoint to just anybody in a position of authority and leadership. The task of doing God's work, the work of overseeing the people of God, is too important to be left to just anybody. They must meet the standards of that kind of work. Now, you can see from these qualifications necessary for any man who would help the work with Moses. You can see that. And then you can go to Ephesians and Corinthians and these other places in the New Testament where Paul lays out the qualifications of elders and deacons. And you know, I doubt very much that when General Electric or DuPont or Duke Energy or the Walmart chain or the Publix grocery store chain, when they're looking to hire corporate leaders or regional directors in their companies, they consult what we read here in Exodus or look at what Paul says in Ephesians about leadership. Those aren't high on their list, but they're high on God's list of leadership. Now look at verses 22 to 23. because it tells us there what these leaders in Israel were being called to do. And let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they shall decide themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this, God will direct you. You will be able to endure, and all this people also will go to their place in peace. So then that's another priority, and that is being open to the guidance of others. Look at verses 24 to 26. So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all he said. Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, chiefs of thousands, hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And they judged the people at all times. Any hard case they brought to Moses, but any small matter they decided for themselves. See, what we have here, as I said, is a system of ascending courts of justice and appeal. It is a highly decentralized form of government. God's word never, ever envisions a society. I don't care how advanced, how many people, where you've got something anywhere remotely like what we have today as a federal government. And I'm not saying just because Biden happens to be president. It doesn't matter who president is. It doesn't matter what the party is in power. We have a system of government that has gone far beyond the boundaries and the guidance of God's law. It's been that way for centuries. Friends, it doesn't matter who we are, no matter what level of spiritual maturity we have attained, we need to be open to wise and godly advice from others. See, no Christian should ever get to the place that he or she thinks that they do not need to learn anything. No Christian should ever get to the place that he or she thinks that they have no room for growth, or they don't need to revisit issues, or develop and advance in their knowledge of the faith, or that they don't need to improve their knowledge of the Bible or church history or any of the things in the world in which the Lord has placed them. Now, there is a name, however, for being in such a state where you don't learn and you don't grow and you don't develop. It's called being dead. No Christian should ever get to the point that he or she thinks they don't need to be taught anything. Because if we do get to that place, we have just stopped maturing, and indeed we may have stopped living. So there's much to learn from this incident on a personal level, but of equal value. We've got these two poles, the personal and the broad. Of equal value is what this teaches us concerning God's qualifications for judges. We might say politicians, civil leaders. What it teaches us about God's law and the biblical requirement for an orderly society. And I would think, given everything going on in this world today, and I don't care where you live, especially in these United States, especially for folks who live in Great Britain, having an orderly society, I think, is a priority for everybody. Because we don't live in one right now. There is in Scripture an essential relationship between law and morality. But see, in the modern world, there's virtually none. And the essence of status law, the essence of law that's determined by the government, is that something must be considered legal, you see. It reminds me of the great speech that Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian Orthodox Christian and prophet, he made a speech at Harvard. For those of you who don't know, Solzhenitsyn was kicked out of Russia, the Soviet Union, during the Soviet era because of his criticisms of Stalin and the Soviet regime in his novels and his writings. He was exiled to the United States. He spent, I don't know how long it was, 10, 15, 20 years living in the Northeast in Vermont in a small little village. And before he went back to Russia, I think it's when, I'm not sure who it was that lifted the exile, and he went back to Russia. He died some years ago, but he went back to his motherland. But before he did, I think it was in 1978, he was invited by Harvard University to give the speech to the graduates. Not a bad invitation. And there was great anticipation that Solzhenitsyn would stand up and blast the Soviet Union and praise our great American democracy. How shocked they were that he didn't quite do that. Because what he told these people is that our society, compared to that of the Soviet Union, was not that much better. Because, he said, too many people here believe that as long as something is legal, then it's okay. And he asked people to wake up and realize that something can be legal and profoundly immoral. Now, he didn't say this, I don't think, I don't remember, but if you need an example of that, how about abortion? Abortion is legal. but it is off the charts being immoral. Our politicians and our judges today are all hostile to any moral analysis of the law in terms of God's word. If you don't think that's true, make an appointment with your local representative or call the governor's office. And you say, I want to talk to whoever, and I would like for you to go over the law of God for me concerning how government's supposed to work. If you aren't arrested on the spot for being an extremist, you'll at least be laughed out the door. And that's not at all surprising, because if human beings, if man through the state is the source of law, then man will be totally resenting God's declaration that he alone is the sovereign and the lawgiver. Whether it's admitted to or not, that means that humanistic man's greatest enemy is the God of the Bible. And that is why our leaders, and again, I don't care the party, I don't care what posture they take and this, that, and the other, they have waged constant warfare against God. And as we know all too well, this very day, that warfare has increasingly become an open fact. Now, the biblical requirements for a judge are given in verses 21 to 22 and elsewhere in God's law. And over against that, the status requirement is increasingly in favor of the man or a woman, the politician, who is a hack. That is, some crackpot politician for whom justice is the will of his lobbyist or his political party leaders. Our world today is based on the will and whim of evil men and women. And as we conclude this study, let it be our prayer that the Lord would provide us, in contrast, leaders who will obey God's law, and that they will have all of these priorities. Let us pray.